Thanks, Ashwajit. Well, a few weeks ago, Jnana Kethu was here on a retreat and he asked to meet up with me. He wanted to talk to me about the Order weekend. And I thought, yeah, fine, let's meet up to talk about the Order weekend. He wants to talk about who's giving the talks and who, you know, where the study groups are going to be and putting a programme in Shabda. So I innocently went along to meet Jnana Kethu and expecting him to ask me some practical points, some practical questions. And he asked me if I'd give a talk on the Order weekend. And I was kind of caught off guard and my jaw dropped. But I have a kind of a rule of thumb or a little precept that I'll always accept an offer or the challenge to give a talk or to lead study or something like that if I'm asked to. It's a little precept that I kind of took from Padma Vajra a few years ago. So that's why I'm here today. I was caught off guard, and I'll accept the challenge. Jnana Kethu gave me the choice to talk about doubt as a fetter or doubt as a path, and you know we discussed that. Doubt as a path isn't something that I was particularly familiar with. I know about it, but it's not my forte, and it's not my kind of default way of relating to doubt. Doubt as a fetter is more familiar to me, and overcoming fetters, overcoming hindrances is more my way of operating. So I suggested Amra Kathy be approached to talk about doubt as a path, because I know Amra Kathy is interested in this approach, or I guess that. And surprise, surprise, Amra Kathy is here, and so am I. Doubt and indecision lie at the root of our difficulties with the spiritual life. And that is why we have to bring clear thinking to bear. If one doesn't really believe that it is possible to develop as an individual, one won't be able to put into that development the energy that will enable one to develop. This is what Bhante has to say about doubt in the Mind and Buddhist Psychology lecture. I'm not going to talk about doubt as a hindrance in meditation, or doubt as one of the 10 fetters. I'm going to talk about doubt as one of the 6 mula kleshas. The other 5 being raga, or craving, pratigha, or hatred, anger, mana, or conceit, avidya, or ignorance, and drishti, or views, views, wrong views about the nature of self. These are said to be the root defilements, the kind of very core, very essential emotional biases that are surrounded by the 20 upakleshas. So these are the 6 mula kleshas. And yeah, doubt is defined by Yeshe Gyaltsen, Vichikitta is defined by Yeshe Gyaltsen as to be in two minds about the truth. So it's a divided mind, it's to be uncertain, to be in two minds about the truth. And I'm going to explore this being in two minds about the truth in the context of the 3 refuges, the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. And I'm going to try and kind of ask primer questions that if anybody wants to take up in the study group, they're welcome to do that. That was kind of what Jnana Kethu suggested I do. And also that I take a stance on doubt as a hindrance and the other speaker takes a stance on doubt as a path, and hopefully we can kind of create a dynamic tension between the two assertions. So it's not going to be a debate or anything like that, but I'll definitely be taking a stance on it. So one general point about doubt as a klesha, or all of the kleshas, in fact, is that there's something that we do. Doubt is active. It doesn't just happen to us. you know, that doubt kind of befalls us. It's something that we do. We are involved in its creation. Much in the same way as avidya or ignorance is talked about as a willful not knowing, where on some level we turn away from the truth. We don't want to look at things as they really are. In the same way, vichikitta or doubt is seen as a willingful maintaining a state of indecisiveness. It's an act of turning away on subtle and gross levels. It's a doubt, an act of doubt in ourselves and an act of doubt in other people. And this doubting mind leads to indecision. Yeah. It leads us to being in two minds, into states where we don't know what we want to do and we get confused. Yeah. So Yeshe Gyaltsen says that this is, we do this, we create this state for ourselves. So let's take a look at doubt and the Buddha refuge. The Buddha, as we know, was a man, a real person who was born 2,500 years ago in northern India. We can get a sense of the Buddha as a real person who walked around the dusty tracks of India. I picture him in a jungle, surrounded by trees, with insects buzzing. You know, just an ordinary looking person. That's what we'll say. A rather scruffy looking person, rather weather beaten looking person. Not a perfect iconographical golden being, but a real weather beaten person. And one time we come across the Buddha and we see him sitting down. We see this man sitting down and we see him meditating. And he sits and he sits and he sits and he sits and he doesn't move. And then in the middle of the night he opens his eyes and he looks amazed. He looks like he's discovered something really amazing. And according to tradition, one night the Buddha sat down. Well, before he was the Buddha, he sat down and he made a significant breakthrough. He ceased to be Gautama the wanderer, Gautama the ordinary person, and became the Buddha, Gautama the Buddha. What actually happened there? What happened? What do we see? Well, we don't really see very much. All we see is a person sitting down and then not sitting down anymore. But we're told from tradition and from the Buddha himself that he attained complete and perfect enlightenment, that he went beyond all craving, went beyond all ignorance. But what happened is a mystery. We don't know. We weren't there. It's very difficult for us to know what happened. We can have some sort of imaginative connection with what happened. But we don't know. But yet we're all here. We're all Buddhists. We all have some sort of connection, some sort of relationship with his experience. And one of the Buddha's assertions is that anyone, provided they make the requisite effort, can achieve what he achieved, can have the insight that he achieved. And we first hear mention of this when the Buddha surveys the whole of existence with his Dharma eye, and he sees all beings and he likens them to lotuses at different stages of growth in the water. And this episode, this image, comes from a moment of doubt that the Buddha has himself, where the Buddha wonders whether to teach or not to teach what he has discovered, this truth. And he says, if I taught the Dhamma, others would not understand, and that would be wearying and troublesome to me. So the Buddha doesn't know whether or not he's going to teach. Very wonderful moment, very kind of, you know, everything's kind of hanging on the balance when this happens. And then we know Brahma Sahampati entreats the Buddha to proclaim the Dhamma, for some, O Blessed One, will understand. And thankfully for us, the Buddha did teach, and Buddhism, as we know, was born. So according to the Buddha, we can achieve what he achieved. He sees us at different stages of development. Do we believe this? Do we believe that we can achieve what the Buddha achieved? Do we really believe this? And how often do we really believe this? Do we believe that others too can achieve what the Buddha achieved? It's a primary, fundamental statement of the Buddha that we can do this. But do we actually believe this? And speaking for myself, I do generally believe this. I do believe that I can attain what the Buddha attained, and that others can attain what the Buddha attained. But I don't always believe that. That goes in and out of focus for me, belief in myself and belief in others. It may go in and out of focus for other people. And I can remember my early getting involved with the FWBO back in Dublin. I used to meet up with Sangapala every Tuesday afternoon for lunch. She had a number of dates, like three or four people a day, and I had Tuesday afternoon lunchtime. And it was one summer afternoon, and we got a takeaway from this really excellent kind of old-fashioned Italian pizza place called the Steps of Rome. So we got some takeaway pizza and some really nice Italian mineral water. Lying on the grass, sun is shining, Stephen's green, and I'm kind of complaining to Sangapala that I'm not really good enough. I can't really do it. And he got fed up with me, and he said to me, "Hey, pal, myself and Ratna Bandhu just can't even understand why you keep doing this to yourself." Sorry for the terrible accent. And I had a moment of realization where he pointed out to me that I was doing doubt. I was doing self-doubt. That I believed in the Buddha. I believed in enlightenment, but I didn't believe I could do it. And he was able to point out to me that this was something that I was doing in relation to the goal. And I had a kind of a mini breakthrough with that. And I'm very grateful to Sangapala for pointing that out to me, really kind of pointing out when I did doubt. It's not a case of whether we believe or don't believe. That's too static a way of looking at it. It's more fluid than that. We're sometimes more confident in what we're doing, we're sometimes less confident in what we're doing. Yeah. And I think the trick with working with doubt is to identify these processes, when we're doubting, when we're more confident, when faith is present, when doubt is present, just to be able to identify and acknowledge these. So what happens for me is that I sometimes can't sustain the possibility that I can get enlightened. It's unbearable to take that on board sometimes. Emotionally, that can be unbearable. And that comes down to vichikitta. I somehow allow myself to be in these two minds. The possibility of enlightenment or making significant progress can seem terrifying because of the potential change that I know will have to take place. And on some level, that's terrifying. And I allow doubt and indecision to proliferate in my mind and allow myself to stay in a divided and confused state. This is how it manifests for me. So this is doubt in the Buddha refuge. It's not believing that we can achieve Buddhahood or that we can make significant progress, and not believing that others too can make significant progress or achieve Buddhahood, and also not relating to others on the basis that they can achieve enlightenment. It's writing people off. This is doubt and the Buddha refuge. So doubt and the Dharma refuge. Well, none of us would be here if we didn't in some way believe that the Dharma was the truth, or the Dharma was the way or the best way to live. If you were here, it'd be quite bizarre if you weren't here for that reason. But and this is one of the great things about this weekend for me, just knowing that everybody who's here is here for the Dharma. We're all in some way Dharma farers, Dharma practitioners. In one of my favourite suttas, the Buddha actively encourages his disciples to doubt. The famous Kalama Sutta, we find the Buddha being approached by a group of confused townspeople, and they want to gain clarity on which teachers teach the truth and which don't, because some claim to be realised and they criticise the others, and then another group come along claiming to be realised and they criticise everybody else. So they're all confused. They all make claims for themselves. They approach the Buddha and ask him their questions, to which the Buddha replies, "You may well be puzzled, Kalamans. You may well be in doubt, for doubt has arisen precisely about what ought to be doubted." The Buddha goes on to teach them how to evaluate this matter for themselves. Not to rely on tradition, not to rely on hearsay, but to be able to identify what's skillful and unskillful in themselves and in others. So he gives them the tools to be able to make these evaluations for themselves, rather than to be told by somebody else what is true and what is false. Kind of a revolution in thinking. A revolution in thinking. This is not doubt as a klesha. This is a healthy form of doubt, a healthy form of scepticism, where he encourages them to think matters through for themselves. Doubt is a klesha is when you know the facts but can't seem to make up your mind. We're all Dharmaferas, we're all Dharmacharis, we all try to practice the Dharma in a way that works for us. We all have faith in our own practice. Do we have faith in our own practice? Do we believe that our meditation practice that we get up every morning to do is getting us anywhere? Do we have faith, or do we doubt that we are actually on the path? That we are actually on the path to enlightenment. And again, it's probably not as concrete as yes, I do, or no, I don't. It's probably a lot more fluid than that. But again, we need to learn to identify those moments when we're doubting and when we have confidence in what we're doing, because there's a lot of valuable information in that. Do we have faith, or do we doubt the practices that we have in the movement? Meditation practices, for instance. I had a very strong experience this summer. Again, it was another first for me. I seemed to somehow end up leading the summer retreat at Padmaloka, which I was very pleased to do. I was very happy to do. I'd never done it before, and I was aware of the kind of the great responsibility of leading a retreat at Padmaloka, because even though I live here, Padmaloka is still a very, you know, important symbolic archetypal place for me that I happen to spend a lot of time in. And sometimes it dawns on me just how important a place it actually is, even though I'm very familiar with it. But I was teaching the meditation practices mostly to beginners. There was a few more experienced people here. Savannah Garbo was one of them. I just had a real strong sense that I believe in the basic practices of the FWBO. I believe in the mindfulness of breathing. I believe in the metta bhavana. I believe in retreats. I believe in pujas. Even though I don't particularly like pujas, I still believe in them. I believe in communication. I've known this, but I had a real strong sense, I actually do believe this stuff. I can offer what I know of these practices to other people. I can get behind this. Particularly with the meditation practices. I thought, well, it doesn't matter if I'm now good at them or if I have a rubbish practice and I never get into dhyana and all the rest of it, that's how it seems to me a lot of the time. I still believe that they work. They in themselves are pristine. The practices themselves, you know, have nothing to do with me. I didn't invent them. I didn't create them. I'm very lucky to have come across them. But I have this real strong sense of, yes, these practices work. You know, I do wonder sometimes myself whether it works, whether meditation works for me. But on the whole, I believe it does. I believe it does. Do we believe in other people's practice? Or are we in two minds about that? Sometimes people seem to have all sorts of weird and wonderful expressions of Dharma practice. Sometimes it's hard to take people seriously. Sometimes we write people off as fake Buddhists. We might not do this overtly or in public, but we might be thinking, loser. Yeah? I might be the only person that does this, and if so, I confess it publicly. But others of you might do that. You know, people who aren't really doing it, whatever the it is, they're not doing it. They don't look like that. And I think it'd be useful to know when you're doing this, identify those moments when you're doubting other people's practice, and at least then you can choose whether to maintain that doubt or choose to look a little bit deeper and see if there's something going on that you're just not aware of, or it's something about that person that you don't like or something that you don't understand. So I think we need to look deeper sometimes, and maybe on closer examination you'll find that there's some treasure in there. Doubt and the Sangha refuge. The history of Buddhism is a long history of people trying to practice the Dharma, trying to achieve what the Buddha achieved. It's a history of successes and it's a history of failures. It's a history of the most mind-bending doctrines right down to the most simple and straightforward instructions. But most of all, it's a history of people. Yeah, a history of people. Of ordinary people trying to practice the Dharma. History generally records the famous ones, the big hitters, the big names, the ones who wrote the books. History is also recorded by history is recorded by the types of people that record history. So they don't get everybody. We just have the written history by the people who write history. There was a lot more going on in Buddhist history than just what got written down. We often forget that there have been millions and millions of ordinary people, of ordinary Buddhists, who practice the Dharma. They are the Sangha. That's also our lineage. It's not just the enlightened ones, great as they are. A lot gets said about them, but I want to just kind of put a word in for all the millions of strugglers who never made it. I'm with you strugglers, wherever you are. I might be one of them. Yeah, history might forget us. We think we're going to go down in history, but we might not. It might all go. So within this vast Mahasangha of all Buddhists, past and present, made up of ordinary people just like us, we have the order, we have the movement, we have the FWBO. Our Buddhist tradition that history may or may not remember. So our Sangha within the wider Buddhist Sangha, do we believe that it works? Do we have doubt about ourselves as an organisation? Do we have faith in one another? And are we willing to share what we have with others? Or are we afraid that somehow the FWBO is some sort of counterfeit Buddhism? That somehow the allegations in the FWBO files have managed to sneak in past your firewall and are kind of in there as a little virus undermining your faith? Do we have a wavering, oscillating confidence in ourselves as bona fide Dharma farers? In our practices, in our principles, in our precepts, the three P's. Are we truly leading a life? Are we truly on the Dharma path, the path of true Dharma, of Sadharma? Do we have confidence in the capacity of other Oda members? Or are we slightly worried that it's all going wrong? That somehow it's all going wrong. The order is going wrong. There's something wrong. The chaos. It's not right. Yeah. Are we worried that it's all going wrong? Or can we embrace this chaos? Do we embrace the chaos as a success, as a sign of success, or as a sign of failure? Question. I have my doubts about myself. Sometimes about myself as an order member, that I'm not a proper order member or a proper Buddhist, whatever that is. I certainly doubt it. I'm not good enough to be an order member. I shouldn't really be giving a talk on a National Order Weekend, but if people really knew what I was like, they'd stand up and announce me as a fake, and I'd have to walk out with my head in shame. And when I'm racked with doubt as myself, as an order member, as a bona fide order member, as a bona fide Buddhist, sometimes I bring to mind my ordination. Bringing that to mind really helps. Especially that moment when the preceptor asks you, are the three refuges complete? You're sitting there, and he says to you, looking you in the eye, are the three refuges complete? I had a very vivid experience of this 2 weeks ago when we had five men being ordained in this shrine room by Padmavajra and Surata. And it's such a strong statement. Are the three refuges complete? And then they're told to say, I'm a Bante. Yes, Bante. But they mean it. I meant it when I said it. You're told to say it because you say, you know, it's a ritual, and there's a ritual form, and it's important to observe the forms in the ritual to make the magic work. So they say, Amabante, and that's acknowledged. And then the ceremony proceeds. And it's a chance for us to say, yes, yes, wholeheartedly, yes, I'm doing it. Yes, for once in my life, with total certainty, I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing. I'm serious. I mean it. And then he says back to you, yes, I know. I know you're serious. I see it. We all see it. And it's on that basis that you get ordained. In the private and the public ceremony. It's incredibly affirming. It's an incredibly potent magic ceremony that we've all been through. We're also told, don't forget it. Don't forget this moment. We do forget it. We do forget it. It's so easy to forget it, to get lost in the distraction, to get waylaid by whatever. But that's still there. That defining moment is still there for all of us as a reference point. And for me, it's a great source of inspiration when I lose course and when Vichikitsa takes over and I'm doubting myself as an order member. I find that doubt can have a very energy-sapping effect. Even small things, like going to the shop to buy a treat, to buy a bar of chocolate, that sometimes the choice can be so overwhelming. It's like, what do I get? Do I buy something expensive? Is it worth spending? Which is the cheapest? The weight? That's only like 70 grams. That's better value for money. That's got more fat in it. Well, something with nuts in it, that's got protein, so it kind of cancels it out. You know, sometimes I wish there was just one thing, so there was no choice, and I wouldn't have to waver. What am I going to buy? But on bigger things, I've wasted so much time being in inner conflict about what to do, about this, that, or the other. Should I stay? Should I go? Should I be doing this? Should I be doing that? Is this the right thing to do with my life? Is that the right thing to do with my life? I've spent hours, maybe years, in that state of mind. I've listened to friends for hours and hours and hours. Should I stay in the relationship? Should I go back to her? Should I do this? Should I become a novelist? Am I an artist? Am I all of these things? Yeah. Now, I've done it as well, so forgive me if you're one of my friends and I'm blowing my cover. I've done it equally. But it got so bad for me sometimes, this internal conflict, that I came up with a bit of a precept. And again, I think it was inspired by Sangapala, which was, how long am I prepared to stay in a negative mental state? He used to teach this on the beginner's courses when he was teaching the Metta Bhavana. How long are you prepared to stay in that mental state? And it's quite, how long am I prepared to stay in that mental state? So I've kind of come up with a bit of a rule of thumb. A month to 6 weeks. Maybe 2 months maximum on big issues. That's how long I'm going to stay in an undecided state. If at the end of the 6 weeks or the 2 months maximum, I haven't decided, I either decide that I'm not going to decide, I consciously go, I cannot decide, I don't have enough, I'm going to put this down, yeah, and then I make sure I leave it, yeah, just to improve the quality of life, because it's such an energy sapper, being in that undecided state, and then return back to it and then make the decision. But that might seem a bit kind of, cut and dry and kind of old school FWBO, just kind of make up your mind and kind of go on out there and, you know, be a hero. It works. I'd recommend it. I don't want to spend my life being divided in this state of vichikitta. I don't want to spend my life in being grabbed by the kleshas. And how long am I prepared to be in this state? So I'm not advocating a premature or hasty forced decision-making process. But it is important to become clear when you are in the grip of doubt. And then you've got the choice about whether you do something about it. So doubt, vichikitta, is a klesha. It's a mula klesha. It's an emotional inability to make up one's mind one way or the other. It leads to or manifests as indecision. In particular, vichikitsa is doubt or indecision in regard to the Dharma, with what we know to be the truth. And we need to know how to identify it and work with it so that we don't spend too much time in an unsatisfactory mental state and can get on with our Dharma practice. Thank you.